now. Coming up, calls increased for Attorney General Alberto Gonzalez to clarify his comments about White House inner workings, and one law professor says he should be impeached. But first, news from Wall Street as bruised investors warily came back to work this Monday, jittery after last week's sucker punch, stocks tumbling, fears of a coming credit crunch. Matt Goldstein, associate editor of Business Week, joins us for a brief update. And Matt, we know Monday's important, you know, back to work and everything. But we're also reading reports that Mondays have become the days when Wall Street announces those big deals that set the weak tone for global financial markets. They call it Merger Monday. So what's happening this Monday?
Well, you know, that has been historical, that mergers do tend to get announced on Mondays. And today there were a few, but not hugely significant deals. And I do think you're not going to see many deals getting announced on Mondays or any other day for the time being, particularly as long as this credit crunch goes on, particularly in the part of the market that's been used by a lot of these private equity firms to fuel these huge mega buyouts. That's what's really sort of worrying Wall Street right now and investors, is that the market for selling, for people to buy these loans that have to fund these deals, no one wants to buy them right now.
Right.
There's sort of a buyer's strike is what people are calling it.
Well, and that leads to this, you know, as you said, credit crunch, the idea that these big deals that we're going to go through, there's no money to follow through with them. But what else is behind this credit crunch?
Well, you know, to some extent, part of it is just the sheer amount of deal making that you've seen announced this year at record levels, and private equity firms had raised so much money. The volume of loans to fund these deals, most of these deals, they're funded mainly with debt, which is in the form of bank loans or bonds, is at record levels. It's like $200 billion, which is the backlog of loans to be funded. And if you look at it a year ago, there were only $60 billion.
So, we understand, too, that lenders are feeling that maybe the price of money is a little bit too low, that the borrowers have been getting money too cheaply, and now these lenders want a little more bang for the bucks they're going to lend.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, the banks were basically bending over backwards, the private equity firms basically giving them everything they wanted with these, you know, very low rates, and also deals on loans that were, you know, bizarre terms that almost looked sort of what was going on in the subprime housing market. And essentially, the ones who buy these loans, institutional investors, pension funds, mutual funds, they're sort of balking now, saying, you know, we've already had our full of this. We don't want to pay at these rates. We want to get, you know, loans that are going to be a little more productive for us.
Well, I was going to ask you, is this just a short-term punishment, or do you think this is going to be a real shift?
Well, you know, what's going to be real is that there's definitely going to be a repricing of these loans. The days of easy money are ending, and that's why you're not going to see as many deals going forward. It's going to be much harder to put deals together. Mm. The bigger question is whether we're on the verge of something more serious happening, you know, i.e., a potential recession or a bear market in the stock market. And I think that's sort of what you see in the market today. It's been very uncertain. It's a little bit up. It's a little bit down. No one really knows where we're sort of going. And right now we're on the potential where we could be headed for something far more serious, but it's really sort of too soon to say.
Well, you mentioned the subprime mortgage loans. These are people who perhaps seduced into taking out loans on homes at rates they could afford, but now those, you know, interest rates are rising. They can't afford them. They're foreclosing. And we're reading that this problem has been migrating to other mortgage categories.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, Countrywide Financial, which is a big lender, a mortgage lender last week, said that they are, and their stock got hammered, and that actually helped set off a lot of the market sell off last week, saying that they're seeing it going up to what is called Alt-A loans, which are loans not necessarily to people with very bad credit histories, but sort of in between market. There's foreclosures are continuing to rise. The big concern is that also a lot of people, even people with good credit histories, took out variable rate mortgages. And these will all start to reset in the coming months, where basically the rates in them will tick higher. And that will basically mean that mortgage payments will go up for people. And that's where we're going to have to really start to see real worry, because that could impact on consumer spending. And as everyone knows, the consumer really is what drives the market and drives the economy.
So with not a lot of money around to either borrow to push business forward or to pay off loans that already exist, people may be pulling into their turtle shells a little bit. But on the other hand, we see some strong corporate earning reports today.
Well, I was just going to say that. I mean, that's the flip side. I mean, right now, you know, for the most part, earnings have done pretty well. They've done good. The expectation is that in the fourth quarter, there's going to be strong economic growth and profit growth. you know, there's no real signs of a recession on the horizon. I mean, basically what you have had is a very long bull market that's getting old and tired, so it's normal to start seeing some pullback. Really, you know, the jobs numbers going to be coming out on Friday will be very important to see what happens there. I mean, as long as unemployment stays low and the people are not losing their jobs, there's the expectation that spending will still continue. And probably what's going on in the LBO market will start to filter out and shake out. Like I said, the question is really going to be what's going to happen in the next few months, and anyone can make a guess what's going to happen. No one knows for sure.
Matt Goldstein is associate editor of Business Week magazine. So we end on that unsure note again. Matt, thanks so much.
Thanks for having me.
Well, the stock market isn't the only thing on wobbly footing. Approval ratings for Congress have sunk to historic lows. Right now, only about 25% of Americans think Congress is doing a good job. That's lower than the president's 30% approval rating. So lawmakers are anxious to get something significant accomplished just this week before they head home for summer break and possible encounters with angry constituents. Topping the agenda, health care legislation covering millions of seniors and children, Iraq war funding, lobbyist reform. But the standoff between congressional Democrats and the Bush administration over subpoenas for Karl Rove and others and possible perjury charges against Attorney General Alberto Gonzalez could overshadow everything else. Our conversation today, Congress. What happened? With Gail Chadwick. She's senior congressional correspondent for the Christian Science Monitor. Gail, welcome.
Good to be with you, and welcome back.
Do you have an answer to that question, by the way? I mean, this new democratically led Congress said they came in with a mandate for change, so is it too simple to say what happened was Iraq?
No, that's precisely what happened. If you look at when the confidence rating plunged, and the poll that I think shocked most people on the Hill was in June 21st when the Gallup poll reported a 14% confidence rating in Congress, which is just off all previous charts. And that, when they asked people why, it was Iraq. That people felt that the Congress had been elected to rein in the war, and they had just, in May, passed a supplemental spending bill to fund it again. And that there was a real reaction to that.
Well, and this could be the sticky wicket of all sticky wickets as they try to make their way out of it. Democrats do have few successes to point to. They passed an anti-terror bill enacting the recommendations of the September 11 Commission. Mm-hmm. The president's expected to sign that into law. They approved a hike in the minimum wage. Today, senators are going to consider proposals to renew the S-CHIP program. Let's talk about some of the stuff on the slate for the week. This is the state children's health insurance program. It provides health insurance for about 6 million kids, most from low-income working families. Now, we hear some of the pushback against this renewal is from the tobacco lobby. This added insurance would be paid for by increased taxes on tobacco. So why haven't Democrats made more political hay out of this, you know, tobacco versus kids?
Well, many of the House Democrats, for example, come from tobacco areas, so this is by no means an easy issue for them as well. And on the House side, a lot of the funding is going to come from Medicare programs that deal with seniors. So there is pushback on both sides. But I think what's happening this week is an effort to balance three concerns. One is the Iraq War, which is a permanent fixture on the Hill now. That is the monster issue that will not go away. Another is oversight, going after the Attorney General, going after Justice Department policies, going after contractors, going after the war, the kind of show trial aspect of it. And then the last is legislation. Can we pass things that the American people will notice in their lives? And that's why S-CHIP is important.
Well, let's go over all three of those things. First of all, do you think the S-CHIP will likely pass the renewal?
I think it will in the end, but it's going to be a real fight, especially over funding. This is something that Republicans on the Senate committee that passed this last week, all but three Republicans voted with the Democrats on a deal on S-CHIP. What they're doing is proposing $35 billion instead of $50 billion that the House is proposing and that the budget allowed for. So they're going to hold very close to this issue. Republicans don't want to vote against health care for poor children.
Right. Let's go to Iraq. The House scheduled, as you said, to debate the $460 billion defense appropriations bill. Democrats plan to introduce some measures that could stall it. But what's your sense of what's going to happen with that?
Oh, I think it's going to be the Iraq war all over again. You have on that bill proposals for an amendment that would cut back, that would require the president to begin reducing U.S. military presence 60 days after enactment. It doesn't have a deadline, but it's still... is a direct slap at the surge.
We also understand there's going to be an amendment to close Gitmo, other hugely debatable items.
Another one that the troops be fully trained and equipped, and another that surprised me a lot. On Friday, the House Armed Services Committee voted with all but two Republicans a requirement that the administration report to Congress within 60 days on its plans to withdraw troops from Iraq. That's the sort of thing that a year ago you couldn't have gotten Republicans to support.
Well, and let's just take a couple minutes here to talk about the standoff between Congress and Attorney General Alberto Gonzalez. I want to try to walk a little bit through what we think we know about this story so far. Gonzalez's critics say he lied in testimony to Congress about whether there were disagreements in the Justice Department over the president's terror surveillance program. Gonzalez told Congress there was no infighting over the president's warrantless wiretapping program. But then others, including Deputy Attorney General James Comey, said there had been a big fight over the surveillance program. In fact, part of it happened at John Ashcroft's hospital bed.
Yeah, a particularly ghoulish aspect to the story.
Now a report in yesterday's New York Times says Gonzalez may not have been technically not telling the truth, because the infighting may have been over a portions of the surveillance program called data mining, looking through records of phone calls and emails. And Gonzalez was never asked directly about that. So what's the thinking on that today?
Well, he has been given an opportunity, a very pointed opportunity, by the chairman of the Senate Judiciary Committee, Senator Patrick Leahy, to correct any misstatements in his testimony, with a reminder that is not typical for these letters, that he was speaking under oath when he did. It'll be very interesting to see how exactly he corrects any of those misstatements. But his responses are often sufficiently vague that it does leave room for such an interpretation. I don't think the returns are in yet on whether or not that's accurate. I do think he's going to have a problem with the FBI director's testimony last week, because he was very explicit that that the confrontation in which Justice Department officials threatened to resign was over the NSA program. He said that has been much discussed, but that is widely interpreted to mean not data mining, but terror surveillance.
Warrantless wiretapping. And you're referring to FBI Director Robert Mueller.
Exactly.
Who contradicted Gonzalez as well. Well, it's set up to be an interesting week. And as usual, Gail Chadwick, Christian Science Monitor, thanks so much for outlining it for us.
Thank you.
Well, and Alberto Gonzalez was also asked in earlier congressional testimony about whether there was warrantless wiretapping. He, in effect, said no. It turns out at that time it had been in effect for 3 years. So, with all of this, one law professor says Alberto Gonzalez should be impeached. We'll speak to Jonathan Turley next, Here and Now. Now, we've been talking about Congress and what lawmakers can get done in just this 1 week they have before they break for August recess. 1 week is also the amount of time Attorney General Alberto Gonzalez has been given to clarify what he told the Senate Judiciary Committee last week. And if he can't do that, there's been a threat of a perjury investigation. Gonzalez told senators there was no serious disagreement within the administration about the secretive wiretapping of terror suspects. But 2 days later, the head of the FBI suggested that Gonzalez had lied about that. There was serious disagreement, and it went all the way to the hospital bedside of John Ashcroft. Here's what Senate Judiciary Committee Chair Patrick Leahy told reporters this morning.
Frankly, I feel that a number of the answers the Attorney General gave were incorrect. I hope he takes this opportunity to give correct answers. If he doesn't, there are many, many in the Senate, both Republicans and Democrats, who feel he has not told the truth.
Well, we turn now to Jonathan Turley, law professor at George Washington University. Jonathan, Leahy threatened a perjury investigation. What do you think should happen if, in fact, Alberto Gonzalez has lied to Congress?
Well, I would say that I'm surprised by how many opportunities Alberto Gonzalez has been given to do a very simple task, that is to speak truthfully and clearly under oath. And what's strange is that all of the statements being made by the Justice Department about how it's partially true or how he was able to parse words, those arguments are routinely rejected by the Justice Department in perjury and obstruction prosecutions. We have plenty of people who have been prosecuted on a far less compelling basis. If you look at Scooter Libby, he actually had a better claim to make that he didn't, lie to investigators than does Alberto Gonzalez, because Alberto Gonzalez has appeared repeatedly and misled or lied to Congress on numerous occasions.
Well, let's back up there. What do you think of the story in yesterday's New York Times that actually what Gonzalez is doing is splitting legal hairs? That there was no disagreement about the warrantless wiretapping, that the hospital room meeting at the bedside of then-Attorney General John Ashcroft, the battle there was about data mining. It's an aspect of the program, one that hasn't been acknowledged by the White House, and one he wasn't directly asked about.
But that's exactly the argument that the Justice Department regularly rejects by people they bring before the grand jury, that they don't accept that someone can say, well, you didn't ask me, point blank on every issue, and so I can claim I was thinking about this or that. Well, they reject those. People like Scooter Libby and others have argued stuff like that. And, the fact is he knew they were talking about the domestic surveillance program. That's what the hearing was about. But also he has other points that he's been accused of lying about. He said, for example, that he didn't speak with any staffers about the U.S. attorney's firing. It turns out that he did. He spoke with one of the most critical people involved.
Is this Monica Goodling?
And so, mm-hmm.
Is this Monica Goodling?
And so you have people who have on point blank contradicted what he has said. Now, what amazes me is the degree to which Congress has tolerated this. I mean, this is the most flagrant series of contempt that I have seen in my entire life. And Congress has a couple of things they can do. The first thing they did was correct. They called on the president to fire him. But when the president refused to do that, then they have two options. They could move to hold him in contempt, or they could impeach him. And I think, frankly, impeachment is what they should do.
Well, no, remind us, because it impeaches that word that people sometimes stumble over. Some people feel impeach means to remove from office. By impeach, you mean what?
But impeach means to remove from office. You cannot just.
But doesn't it mean to try? Doesn't it mean to try him? In other words, to.
Yeah, there's a trial. Yeah, and you're convicted. You are charged in the House, and then you are tried in the Senate, and you can use it not just for a president, but for a cabinet officer. And I think what this Congress should have said is, Mr. President, you can do what the right thing is to do. You can remove him, but if you don't, then there is another institution that can remove him, and that is the United States Congress. And they've got grounds. Not only has he been accused, I think, with compelling reason of perjury, but I think the domestic surveillance program is a very, very straightforward case for impeachment. What the president ordered and what Alberto Gonzalez played a role in carrying out is defined as a federal crime under federal law. And the reason I think that the Democrats have not moved for impeachment is because they're embarrassed, because some of the Democrats knew about the domestic surveillance program.
Well, let me hold you up right there, because you make a very strong case, but let's flip it over and look at the other hand. A Wall Street Journal op-ed piece by former Reagan Justice Department officials David Rifkin and Lee Casey, they write, this is an increasingly sordid game of political gotcha. They say Gonzalez did nothing inappropriate, and they argue that the terrorist surveillance program was authorized under the president's constitutional powers, that Democrats went along with it, as you just said, and that it would allow for the reading of suspicious faxes, emails, text messages anywhere in the world. They go further than the data mining program, which is only, the record of when those things were set, not the content. So, we've talked before about this White House's push for executive privilege. Is this a part of that? And what do you think of that argument?
Well, these are the same people that have argued, for example, that the president under the enemy combatant policy can take a citizen, strip him of his constitutional rights, block him from courts and counsel, by simply George Bush saying he's an unlawful or enemy combatant. People will say that. This administration has extremists who have made the argument that the president has these all-powerful sort of powers. And, you know, very few people in the legal community agree with that. Certainly the American Bar Association doesn't. Many judges do not. And, in fact, when the domestic surveillance program was recently found unconstitutional in Detroit, it went to the Court of Appeals where that judge was reversed. But the judges reversed on a technical grounds. And one of the only judge that looked at the issue agreed with her that it was unconstitutional.
Jonathan Turley, we spoke about a couple things here. We spoke about perjury investigation, impeachment. We didn't mention a special prosecutor. I just want to give you a few seconds to say that can happen because the independent counsel law expired.
Right. I mean, the Democrats are now learning the dangers. When they let the independent counsel law expire, they now have no one independent to proceed with this prosecution. And I think this really gives sort of a warning to the wise that they were so eager to kill the independent counsel law after the Clinton administration, they didn't think ahead.
Jonathan Turley, professor of law at George Washington University, thanks so much. Back in a moment, here and now. Now, if Nicholas Negroponte has his way, the information gap between rich and poor will be closing. Nicholas is the younger brother of former intelligence czar John Negroponte, but gained his own fame in the high-tech field. And now Nicholas has founded One Laptop Per Child, a Cambridge, Massachusetts-based nonprofit that's developed a sturdy, crank-powered computer for distribution to kids the world over. The company has started mass production and plans to ship at least 3 million laptops beginning this fall. Here now is Kurt Nickisch as the story of this small firm on the verge of a big global reach.
In a high-rise office building in Cambridge, a dozen volunteer programmers wearing T-shirts and flip-flops are debugging software under the buzz of fluorescent lights.
Then I rebooted the kernel, and just for this reason, I now have all the input devices, but I can't move the mouse anymore.
Around them, whiteboard walls are splattered with magic marker flowcharts. The 10th floor windows look out at the lofty Boston skyline, but some are taped with photos of children in squat African villages. The stark contrast is a reminder of the far-flung developing world these computer developers are trying to change.
It's such a simple idea.
That's Nicholas Negroponte. Before starting the nonprofit, One Laptop Per Child, he ran the Media Lab at MIT, just around the corner from here. That's where the idea was born, to create a low-cost laptop for the world's poorest children.
On the surface, you know, laptops, those are for office workers in rich countries and... So when you say one laptop per child, at first blush, it sounds almost ludicrous. It's like a Mercedes-Benz for every pedestrian or something. It doesn't sound right.
But the laptop nicknamed the XO doesn't look like your office laptop either. To start with, it's cute, two-tone, white and a kind of bright green, think Kermit. The XO is about the size of an Etch-a-Sketch and about as light. While the screen pops up like a regular laptop, it swivels and has wireless antennas that flip up like little frog ears. But this laptop is no toy. Negroponte says it's designed to change the world.
If we could get kids around the world to grow up in more communication with each other, as well as having the opportunity to learn, this is going to be a far better place than it is now.
That's a dream shared by Chief of Content Walter Bender. He says One Laptop Per Child designed the XO for harsh conditions, rugged enough for children to carry through deserts and rainforests.
Why every laptop doesn't have a handle? I mean, come on. I mean, that's just common sense.
More common sense. Unlike other laptops, the screen can be read in bright sunlight. It's low power, though, and in remote areas without electricity, the battery can be recharged with a foot pedal. No customer service out there either, so the XO has been simplified so kids can fix them. Bender says the team tried to make each part both innovative and inexpensive.
We agonized over whether or not we should include a camera, because a camera is going to increase the price of the laptop by $2.19, I think, at the time we were making the decision. But it turns out that that's probably $2.19 well invested, and we decided to go add the camera regardless.
One way the project is keeping costs down is by using free software. There's an encyclopedia, a drawing program, one to compose and play music. Kids will be able to work together because the laptops link to each other wirelessly. If one XO is connected to the internet, others can daisy-chain off that connection miles away. Bender says that's going to unleash some unbelievable creativity.
Photojournalists, because these, you know, 5 or 10 million kids out there who have never had access to anything, suddenly are going to have a video camera connected to the internet. And they're going to be, you know, blogging, posting the YouTube. We're going to see a side of the world we've never seen before.
In all, the XO costs $175. The hope is for that price to drop as more countries sign on. Getting the first commitments has been up to the head of One Laptop Per Child, Nicholas Negroponte. He traveled 9 days out of 10 this past year, pleading his cause to leaders such as Libya's Muammar al-Gaddafi. He tells them the future of their countries will be richer if they buy these machines in bulk now.
Kids after the 4th, 5th, if they're lucky, 6th grade, drop out of school in developing countries. The reason they've dropped out of school is because it's boring. It's truly boring. I think what you're going to find, kids staying in school and kids going to school, because school will suddenly become fun.
And Negroponte points to pilot projects that are testing the XO in schools around the globe. In this classroom in Brazil, 6-year-olds are taking pictures of each other with the computer's camera. "Do I have my finger on the little ball?" asks one girl. She wants to click the onboard mouse to take a picture. At another school in Thailand, kids are writing songs together. From Nigeria is Ayou Kusamutu. He's working for the government there, planning the distribution of laptops. He's seen them being tested at one school. Kusamutu says the children are captivated by the XO.
"They take it home every day. So they don't just use it in school. They take it home every day. And their family can use it. You know, you have a bunch of children growing up saying, you know, Google as their first words, you know, so they can use it to check farm prices, they can use it to do things in the community, do their homework."
Despite Kusamutu's enthusiasm, many still question whether even low-cost laptops are worth it in countries where children have little medicine or food. Among the critics, Microsoft CEO Bill Gates. He started a foundation that's donating billions to fight disease around the globe.
"If you look at the order of priorities, there's large parts of the world where the health issues really trump everything else. You don't have electricity, you don't have literacy, and so computing is not at the top of the list of things that create these inequities."
But others say the XO could reduce those inequities. Josh Burnoff works at Forrester Research in Kendall Square, just down the street from One Laptop Per Child. "Just look around," he says, "at all the tech businesses and jobs here, everything computers have done for the U.S. Then, Burnoff says, try to imagine the promise low-cost laptops hold for the developing world.
It's a mind-boggling thing. And I think for these kids who may identify much more with what's happening in their village than what's happening half a world away, maybe now they get a bigger perspective on where they fit into things. They can develop friendships, relationships, even ideas about how business works in other places in the world."
That's Burnoff's heart. His head sees major logistical obstacles for the project.
"This is a huge experiment. You know, if we put 500,000 or 1 million computers into a country like Libya or Thailand or Brazil, what will happen? We'll have to wait and find out."
Maybe not that long anymore. One Laptop Per Child says it's close to having 3 million orders for the machines, the green and white laptops designed to reduce poverty and change the developing world, are scheduled to start rolling off the assembly line in October.
That's Here Now's Kurt Nickisch. By the way, this music was generated from the XO's music program Tam Tam. For more, you can go to our website, here-now.org. And while there, this reminder, you can listen to today's show stream live. For past programs, you can just click on the archives, and you can also download a podcast. Take us with you wherever you go. That's here-now.org. And before we go today, the new sound of soul at the newly reborn Stax Records. You're listening to Here and Now. Hey. 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 Oh.
me du?
Jeg døden.
Kommer du for å hente meg?
Jeg har redan lenge gått ved din side.
The films were in Swedish, but even with English subtitles, Americans were sometimes baffled by the intense, often disturbingly psychological films of Ingmar Bergman. In that scene from the Swedish director's groundbreaking 1957 film, The Seventh Seal, a knight, played by Max von Sydow, meets Death, played by Bent Ekeroth, just before they begin to play what could be one of the most famous chess games in cinema history. Earlier today, Ingmar Bergman himself met Death. He passed away at his home in Faro, Sweden, at the age of 89, leaving a legacy of over 50 films, including Smiles of a Summer Night, Cries and Whispers, and Fanny and Alexandra. And joining us to talk about Ingmar Bergman's work is Boston Globe film critic Ty Burr. Ty, let's start with The Seventh Seal. It was an allegory set during the Black Plague, and as we said, it had that famous chess scene. What impact did it have on cinema?
It has the famous chess scene and, of course, the famous, much-parodied image of Death leading people across the, you know, the top of the mountain.
This hooded Death. I mean, didn't Monty Python actually have a character that parodied?
Everybody has parodied that over the years. And yet, when you see the movie, it still has just a profound impact. His movies were serious in a way that nobody had ever really tackled before. They really opened cinema to spiritual inquiry, philosophical inquiry. Many people had tried to make films that weren't just serious dramas, but that addressed some of the more profound questions of human life. And he was one of the first to find a narrative way of doing that.
And perhaps one of the first to use his own psychology in his films. He's said that he had an unhappy childhood, a strict minister father, and he explored his childhood in Fanny Alexander. And his marriages in films like Cries and Whispers and Scenes from a Marriage, which tells you that some of those marriages had rough going.
Right. And, you know, the two great themes in Bergman's work are the man's search for God and meaning and the battle between the sexes, the unending incomprehension between men and women.
Right. He worked with women he also loved. Here's his longtime collaborator, former lover, Liv Ullmann. She starred in a number of his films, had a daughter with Ingmar Bergman. Here she is talking about what it was like to work with him in a 2002 interview.
He allows me to use everything which is creative within me. He probably has allowed me to use as much as I know about my craft. There is no secrets anymore of things that has not been challenged. He allows me to be challenged, and if I am not, it's my fault. It is not him.
Ty Burr, as a critic, what did you see Bergman bring out in performers?
He evolved over the course of his career from it. He was an enfant terrible in the early days in Swedish stage and in film, where he would throw chairs, he would rip phones off walls, he had to have his own way. And I think he mellowed, and his films reflect this, he mellowed over the years to allow his inner circle of actors to improvise. He really built a family, a caring family of creative endeavor. And you can really chart that growth over the course of his filmography. And I actually think he has two sort of distinct series of masterworks. So the ones everybody knows are, you know, Wild Strawberries and The Seventh Seal and The Virgin Spring in the early 60s. In the mid-60s, starting with Persona, he started turning out these movies that were much more profound and mature and in a way hopeful, but also more abstract. Shame, A Passion of Anna, all the way up to Cries and Whispers.
Yeah. I feel as if I can draw a line directly from Bergman to, you know, Woody Allen. Can you see his influence on other filmmakers?
Oh, absolutely. And in fact, I think, you know, Woody Allen is somebody who can be imitative of Bergman without always achieving his, you know, complexity and his impact. I think actually he's been forgotten by the younger generation of filmmakers. I was just talking to an intern here at the Globe today who said, yeah, she'd heard of him, but she hadn't seen any of his movies. And I think that because he hasn't made movies in, you know, over 20 years, people know the name, but they need to rediscover the movies. And arguably, I think his death will prompt some people to go out and rent Seventh Seal and rent Persona and realize that these are still staggeringly modern movies.
We've been remembering the late Swedish director Ingmar Bergman with Boston Globe film critic Ty Burr. Ty, thanks so much.
Thank you, Robin.
And we'll go out with music from Ingmar Bergman's Cries and Whispers. We'll come back with the music of Stax Records. That's after a break, Here and Now. Thank you. This year marks the 50th anniversary of Stax Records, the Memphis, Tennessee-based record label that gave the world Otis Redding, Sam and Dave, Isaac Hayes, and countless other soul music legends. But this 50th anniversary isn't going to be some dusty trip down memory lane. The Stax label is being relaunched with a host of new acts. First out of the gate is Soul Live. Their new release, No Place Like Soul, comes out today. Here now is Christopher Blagg, talked with a few Stax artists, old and new.
There may be people who've never heard of Stax Records, but everyone's heard Stax Records. The off-copied template of punchy horns, stuttering syncopation, and choppy chicken scratch guitars under a howling larynx-shredding vocalist was born at Stax's Memphis studios. William Bell was an early architect of the sound.
The material is the key. It always starts with a song. You've got to write something that the public will identify with, that's also marketable in the marketplace. You have to really learn the songwriting craft or sign on good writers and producers. That's the key to getting the material.
Hailed as a vocalist, Bell was also quite the songwriter, penning classics like the bluesy Born Under a Bad Sign and the country soul gem You Don't Miss Your Water.
In the beginning, you really loved me.
Bell was there at the beginning, the golden days of soul music, when Stax dominated the airwaves with hits like Otis Redding's Try a Little Tenderness and Sam and Dave's Soul Man. The house band on all the recordings was organist Booker T. Jones, bassist Donald Duck Dunn, Steve Cropper on guitar, and Al Jackson on drums. Booker T and the MGs weren't just session guys. They were family.
We all basically grew up together, Booker and Al Jackson and I and Steven Duck. We were like neighborhood kids and stuff. So being at Stax was just like going to university or something.
Yeah.
We learned our craft at Stax.
All good things come to an end, and Stax was no exception. The label went bankrupt in 1975 after a major shakeup at their parent distributor, CBS Records. A couple years ago, Concord Music Group bought the rights to the Stax imprint, and last December announced the relaunching of the label. Can the magic pick up where it left off 30 years ago? Bell is optimistic.
They stay true to that legacy of Stax, to find the great song, and with the delivery of the artists and the arrangements and musicians to present it, I think they'll be successful, but it takes a lot of work.
To carry the mantle, Stax picked the New York-based group Soul Live as the first act to release a record on the relaunched label. Soul Live is in its own state of transition, from an instrumental trio that focused on funk and jazz to a more soul-based style that demanded vocals. So, Soul Live members Eric Krasno and Neil and Alan Evans invited vocalist Toussaint to join the band. Just slapping the Stax logo on your record doesn't automatically put you on the level with Otis Redding and Isaac Hayes. Soul Live played at Stax's 50th anniversary concert in Memphis last month and met most of the remaining Stax legends. Neil and Alan Evans say it was like crashing a college reunion.
There were people there, they were close friends, they grew up with each other, played music together for years, and here we are just kind of stepping in. You know, and it's almost like people are looking at us like, whose kids are these, you know?
You know, it's kind of like if a friend of yours invited you to their family's, like, summer cookout or something like that. And everyone was really nice, like, oh, it's great to, you know, Soul Live, okay, right, it's great, you know, welcome to Stax, blah, blah, blah. And then they go over like, hey, man, I ain't seen you since 73, you know.
While Soul Live's new release for Stax is brimming with soul, the group doesn't follow the original Stax template to a T. Soul Live is more old school than, say, R. Kelly or Justin Timberlake, but the Evans brothers say they don't intend to become a Sam and Dave cover band.
When you come to see our shows, they might be a little different from the Stax shows of the past. I mean, granted, we, you know, just technology has made great improvements on how loud we're able to play in clubs. You know, we rock when we play a show. And just the different influences that we have, the difference of, from that era, the just all the great music that has come since then, whether it be you know, like all the different funk stuff, rock stuff, electronic music, hip hop.
If the musicians in Soul Live need any reassurance about their place among the hallowed ranks of Stax, rest assured they have an admirer in William Bell.
Great, great band, full of energy, full of good songs, and just looking at them live and everything, I think they are one of the ones that could take up the legacy and keep it intact.
If you ask William Bell about the soul music you find on MTV and mainstream radio these days, you won't get some jealousy-fueled rant about the good old days and how things ain't what they used to be. You get quite the opposite, in fact.
It's a new generation. Just like when we were coming along, we were coming up from the B.B. Kings and the Bobby Blands and stuff like that. And we took what we had been influenced from them and added what we were being and expressed it our way. So that's the same thing that's happening today with the new generation of Soul acts.
Granted, Bell has a point, but don't you wish the Justin Timberlakes and the R. Kellys took a page from Bell and Stax and sounded a bit more like this?
Here now is Christopher Blagg on the relaunching of the Stax record label. For more on Stax, William Bell, and Soul Live, go to our website, here-now.org. Here Now is a production of WBUR Boston. I'm Robin Young. Please join us again, Here and Now.
Funding for Here and Now comes from the MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software, on the web at mathworks.com.
PRI, Public Radio International.
I'm Robin Young. Join us next.